The Spartans, like the Persians, had originally been a tribal monarchy, with a state that had its roots in an ancient nomadic past. Sparta itself, despite its venerable name, was little more than an agglomeration of four villages. Certainly, it owed nothing to the original Sparta of Helen and Menelaus. Impressively, though the couple's tomb loomed over the Lacedaemonian plain, the shrine bore witness to a brutal rupture with the past. Hillocks of buried rubble surrounded it, all that remained of a long-abandoned palace. Around 1200 BC, it and all the other great buildings of Lacedaemon had been sacked and burnt to the ground. Why, and by whom, had rapidly been forgotten. The ruin had been too total for the memory to be preserved. Centuries had passed. Gradually, the void left by the collapse of Menelaus's kingdom had been filled by newcomers from the north, wandering tribes who would be known much later as the Dorians. It would be said of them that there was no nation more devoted to tales of the age of heroes, of the ancient beginnings of cities, and of anything that related to far-off times. The settlers, intrigued by Lacedaemon's pedigree, began to appropriate it to themselves. Around 700 BC, the Spartan elite began to manufacture an ancestry for itself that stretched far beyond the reign of Menelaus, back to the greatest hero of them all, Heracles, slayer of monsters and son of Zeus, the king of the gods. The leading Spartans called themselves Heraclids, and they laid claim, as the heirs of Heracles, not only to Lacedaemon, but to the dominion of much of Greece. All of which, of course, was profoundly alarming for their neighbours. By 700 BC, the Spartans had already achieved the startling feat of crossing the most intimidating of their natural frontiers, the Taygetos Range, and launching a war of annexation in the land of Messenia that lay beyond it to the west. A territory as extensive as Messenia was not easily subdued, but the Spartans, keeping grimly to their objective, had continued for decades to wash its fields and groves with blood. The Messenians' submission, when it came at last, was total. Victory had taken their conquerors more than a century to force. Such an enslavement of one Greek people by another was wholly without precedent. It established the Spartans not only as the richest people in Greece, but as a prodigy, a mutant race, unnerving and unique. Victory, although it brought Sparta great wealth, had done little to ease the miseries of the poor. Indeed, by concentrating even greater resources in the hands of the aristocracy, it had threatened to exacerbate them. A great revolution in military affairs was at that very moment threatening to sink the Heraclids. For it was not cavalry, prancing, expensive, indelibly upper class, that had won Messenia for Sparta. Rather, the victory had gone to plodding foot soldiers, citizens of farming stock, men who may not have had the resources to afford horses, but who could still supply themselves with arms and armour, and in particular with hoplar, circular shields of a radically new design, a metre high and wide, and faced with bronze across their wood. A line of hoplon holders, hoplites, advancing in a phalanx and bristling with spears, was potentially a devastating offensive weapon, and the Spartans, in the course of the Messenian War, had been given every opportunity to experiment with this radical and lethal new form of warfare. Yet it was not easily waged. A particular breed of man was required to make it succeed. Every hoplon, if it were to serve its purpose, had to offer protection to its neighbour as well as its holder, so that the line of a phalanx, as it advanced towards an enemy, risked being cut to pieces on any show of social division. What would be the fate of even the most blue-blooded Heraclid in battle if he could not trust his flank to his neighbour, the humble farmer? And what, even more pressingly, would be the fate of Sparta herself if the farmer could no longer afford his expensive shield? Panic bred a truly extraordinary solution.